we know in general, a chronic migraine, but any chronic disease, so you would say lung, respiratory, chronic diseases, psychiatric chronic diseases that are very expressed in a certain individual, heart chronic diseases, are linked to chronicity of every other part of the body, in the sense that once you become like a person with chronic diseases, the probability, the risk of having another chronic disease beside the first one, or even two or three, is greater. Probably part of it is because all of your biological equilibrium, so your balance of what makes us kind of stable, is starting to get lost or is somewhat unbalanced.
For some people, COVID-19 has come and gone, but for millions of others, its effects linger, sometimes for months or even years. This condition, known as long COVID, can cause a range of symptoms, including fatigue, dizziness, brain fog, and for many, migraine. In fact, for a growing number of people around the world, COVID seems to have sparked migraine or made it worse. So what is exactly happening in the body? Can infections like COVID cause migraine? And what can we learn from this connection to better manage symptoms and find relief? Today, we're joined by Dr. Patricia Pozorosic, a neurologist, researcher, and director of the headache unit at Vall d'Hebron University Hospital in Barcelona. Dr. Pozorosic is one of the world's leading migraine experts and has been investigating how infections like COVID-19 affect the brain and headache disorders. Dr. Pozorosic, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be back at the Migraine World Summit.
Let's start with a bigger picture before we zoom in on COVID. We know that migraine can sometimes worsen or even begin after an infection. How can infections, whether viral or bacterial, lead to migraine or make it worse?
This is an interesting question that probably has not been fully explored, I would say, at a scientific level. But let's go one step back and think about what we know about what migraine is. And migraine really is, I would define it as a neurosensorial vascular inflammatory disorder, which means that inflammation is a part of what is going on in migraine. And that means really that probably there is an increased facilitation, which means that I actually can trigger inflammation easily, or a type of inflammation, maybe not every type of inflammation, but so for a migraine individual, it is kind of easy to trigger inflammation when migraine attacks happen. And if you keep on having attacks very often, that inflammation kind of stays a bit in your body, in your meninges, around I think the whole body. So I always say that probably, and we don't know, but in order to trigger migraine, this is like a circuit, which means that it is there's certain triggers, which I sometimes for easiness I call switches, that can activate or deactivate the circuit. And I do believe that inflammation is one of them. So probably after having an important infection, that might then create a whole inflammatory reaction that might help have more migraine, you would say, or sometimes for some trigger a migraine, migraine disease, you would say, that you didn't know you had before, because unless you start having attacks, you don't know that you're kind of a migraine predisposed individual. Then on top of it, COVID specifically, which is different from other infections, is very, very inflammatory, but also at a vascular level, which means that we know currently that it actually especially affects also the vessels, the small vessels that we have in our body. And that's where migraine pain happens, which is in the meninges. These are a network of blood vessels that are placed on top of our brain, on top of the cortex, we call it, of our brain, and underneath the skull, the bone. So probably all of these inflammatory processes, but specifically that create this endothelial dysfunction in the vessels, probably that doesn't help either, I would say, specifically because in migraine, that is probably one of the key mechanisms that can help, have pain. So there's what we call stress. which is a hypervigilant state that creates fatigue, energy loss, that probably also is very migraine prone, you would say, that it actually also helps. It's another important switch if your fatigue levels are not appropriately kind of controlled. And that can also probably help too. So if we sometimes believe that migraine is somewhat of an adaptive, protective reaction that the body might trigger in order to try and rest and protect itself, developing migraine after all of these things that I'm just mentioning might be a resource that the body finds, you know, kind of internally to actually protect itself and rest and recover.
Does it tell us anything about the immune system and the brain?
Yeah, well, this is something that currently, for example, in our research group, we are trying to explore, I would say, at a preclinical level. So not yet in human beings. But I do believe that your question is probably yes, right? You know, nowadays, what we call migraine is a syndrome. A syndrome in medicine means an adding on, so a number of symptoms. And symptoms are just one of the specific things that I feel are happening to me, in this case, when I have migraine. And this is what, in a scientific level, we would call intermediate phenotypes, which means really that the genetic background, but also the epigenome, so what we are exposed to, can probably trigger different types of migraine, even if the last effector of what is going on could be an increase in potassium levels. But what brings to that point that ends up, you know, triggering all of these symptoms that we know nowadays about might be different things at a genetic level, at an environmental level, at an intrinsic molecular level. And I think that is something that we will continue to understand and explore. And one of them is what you were mentioning, some type of immunological reaction.
Were there other types of infections before COVID that were shown to cause or worsen migraine or chronic headache?
Well, before COVID, when I spoke to patients and taught them a bit, because in every, especially in every first visit that I have with patients, I try to teach them about what migraine is, how they can manage, you know, their migraine. And when I did that before COVID, I mean, I always said that allergies, for example, in the springtime here, at least in Europe, and maybe also infections, especially, as I was saying, respiratory infections, might trigger migraine attacks. And we all know that when we have fever, there is, I mean, the type of pain that a migraine person has is more similar to migraine than just having fever, you know. And some people even, can you imagine, it's hard to imagine that they have fever without having a lot of head pain. And maybe that's the only time when they actually have head pain. So, yes, clearly fever and many different infections, especially respiratory ones, can trigger a migraine attack or migraine pain or migraine-like pain in a predisposed individual.
Since the start of the pandemic, we've seen many people report new or worse migraine symptoms after a COVID infection. What have you and others observed in the research community?
A new migraine, you would say, people that had never had migraine, they started having migraine after a COVID infection. We've seen people worsen, you know, their previous migraine. And that means in our world, you know, an increase in frequency, in the intensity of attacks, the severity, the refractoriness. So the whole thing kind of gets worse. We've seen all of that, but we've also seen other symptoms. If you're thinking about, for example, like a chronic generalized pain syndrome, chronic generalized fatigue, and that goes together with many other kind of inflammatory or non-inflammatory processes around the body. Yeah, I would say that probably everything and anything has been seen. Also some cognitive dysfunction. So, yeah.
Rachel from our community had a question about whether chronic migraine increases the risk of developing long COVID or may make someone more likely to experience neurological symptoms like functional seizures or fatigue. Can you also explain what functional seizures are for our audience?
Sure, yeah. Seizures in neurology are epilepsy. So epileptic seizures, that's what we call a seizure in neurology. Because seizing actually could happen also in other contexts, you would say. But for a neurologist, that's epilepsy. And epilepsy is defined a bit like migraine by the presence of attacks that we call seizures instead of attacks or, you know, that happen every now and then. Usually a little less frequent, but not always, than migraine. So meaning that, yeah, it is a very strong, I would say, neurological sudden dysfunction where all of the electricity that the brain has, in a way, either at a focal level, so a part of your brain, or generalized level, I mean, the whole of the brain, start going like, if it would, like, in Spanish, we would have the word cortocircuito, which means really like if the circuit would kind of...
short circuit?
Yeah, exactly. And all of then the activity, the electrical activity, loses synchronicity because our brains work with waves, you would say, of electric impulse, you would say, yeah. So that's a seizure. Usually seizures are either, I would say, I mean, that's also very generalized, I mean, in a very generalized explanation, but they can happen mainly because of two reasons. One is a neurodevelopmental disorder, meaning that when all of the brain and then what we call axonal and neuronal migration happens when you are being formed, you know, and you're developing as an embryo, that can have problems, you would say, in the sense that not everything, I mean, it's complex to put everything in place. So you might have kind of an issue there on how you were built, you would say, you know, so it's kind of architecture at an architecture level. And that might facilitate that this part of the brain then seizes more frequently, you would say, or seizures in general. So that's one of the main reasons. And then we have other types of seizures, which we call secondary, and they're secondary to brain lesions, sometimes a stroke. It has to be something quite big, and it has to be something that touches the meninges usually, so that also the cortex. That's where the risk of having seizures is greater. Okay, so that's a seizure. And usually we have treatments for seizures. We have ways of diagnosing them with electroencephalography and MRIs, you know, imaging and so on. But then people who seize, but not only, functional disorders are complex too. Sometimes if at an unconscious level, I mean, you are not aware of it, if you are put in a situation of also fatigue, stress, and your brain has understood, you know, that seizing, you know, having a seizure is also somewhat probably protective. At least that's kind of a very simple explanation of what functional disorders could be. Your brain then starts a seizure, which is functional, meaning that it serves a function of protection, but it doesn't really correlate with real electric dysfunction. So you actually have all of the symptoms. But if we would put an EEG or measure your electroencephalography activity, you will not find actually the pattern that we are used to seeing in the EEG that corresponds to an electric seizure. Okay, so that is what we call functional. And functional disorders usually happen in people who already have the disease, meaning that a person who has, let's call them electric seizures, can also have some in-between functional ones. And the percentage of how many functional and how many kind of electric ones you have varies amongst individuals. Some people have zero functional, and others have a lot of functional, like maybe 90% of them. So just that balance is not the same for everyone. So as we were already saying, I also actually believe that some migraine attacks could be functional too, by the way. But that is something that in the migraine field, we are still not, I would say, able to demonstrate because we don't have this biomarker, which is the electric activity that we can measure from the brain. But I am sure that happens too in some migraine attacks, especially in the chronic migraine individuals where there's so many attacks. It's almost unbelievable to think that all of that is linked to such a complex process that or what we know that happens during attacks. But then going back to the question, yes, of course, anything can facilitate anything, and especially if that thing is stressful for the individual, such as long COVID, could facilitate the presence of functional seizures.
And chronic migraine could increase the risk of developing long COVID because the body's already got that stress and fatigue?
We know in general that chronic migraine, but any chronic disease, so you would say lung, respiratory, chronic diseases, psychiatric chronic diseases that are very expressed in a certain individual, heart chronic diseases, are linked to chronicity of every other part of the body, in the sense that once you become like a person with chronic diseases, the probability, the risk of having another chronic disease beside the first one or even two or three is greater. Probably part of it is because all of your biological equilibrium, so your balance of what makes us kind of stable, is starting to get lost or is somewhat unbalanced. Then I also believe that some of the medications, the treatments that we give for one, might actually facilitate a second one. So it's complex to probably understand all of these complexities that are linked.
You don't have to take it in all at once. You can return to extended interviews at your own pace with the All Access Pass. It's interesting to hear you say that, yes, it's true that chronic migraine potentially could make us more vulnerable to long COVID, but so could any other chronic illness that we're struggling with. And yep. So the same is likely true for other, you know, conditions, diseases like that. We had a question from Shana. She said that some people in our community say that they experience new or worsened migraine symptoms after a COVID vaccination, including vestibular symptoms. What does the research show about this? And are there short-term immune responses, or could vaccines be playing a longer-term role?
So the basis of a vaccine is kind of, you know, showing your body, kind of exposing it to a minimal expression of changes by a kind of a mutated type of virus, a fake one even, you know, not the real thing. And then your body kind of starts developing immunity against this vaccine, let's put it, you know. So the day that you will be exposed to, be prepared, you know, with a lot of immunity that will help you fight the disease. So it won't be new. You will be already an experienced, I would say, you know, in a way, individual against that that aggressor, you know, and that aggressor can be a virus or other things that we can get vaccines against. Respiratory illnesses, the vaccines that we have are a challenge. COVID vaccinations, initially, of course, we were little exposed, and it was a virus that was mutating very, very quickly. So they developed a different technique for that. From when we are vaccinated by whatever technique, that creates changes in your body because you have a mild reaction that usually, at least in COVID, that has been kind of measured, can change some at least measurable parameters like blood changes in your blood test and so on for around 3-4 months. This is why, let's say, Carla, if you would come here to Europe now and stay for a while, you would have to get vaccinated for the flu right now here and then go back. And not only because the virus mutates almost, but go back to Australia maybe for the winter and then get vaccinated maybe even again. So you could get vaccinated twice a year. And that's also why in COVID, remember, when we were deep in the pandemic, we could get vaccinated every now and then, you know, because every new strain that comes out. And that's mainly because not only there's a new strain, but because the immunity that is left kind of fades away quickly with this viral type of infections. So I do believe that for some months you're affected by the vaccine, and that in a very sensitive individual might be already enough to trigger a reaction. but it doesn't stay there forever, I would say, you know, the changes. But there's still not enough, probably, research again, because we are lacking some biomarkers that would help us measure that.
Overall, how should people with migraine think about vaccination? Is it still safe and beneficial?
Yes. Well, I am a, you're asking me, you know, probably depending on the person that you ask, there are some very personal, sometimes I think, beliefs. You know, the problem with us human beings is that we are, we have a bit of experience, a bit of science, a bit of everything. And I can tell you that all of the background that surrounds me as a person is very, very, you know, in favor of vaccines. The world, maybe sometimes I think that's for a, not a worse, but for planet Earth, I'm not sure if it's very good that human beings have vaccines, because before people died, you know, very quickly, already in childhood years, families had to have many children in order for two to survive from 10, maybe. And all of this has changed thanks to vaccines. So I would never dream of not vaccinating my child or vaccinating even myself. I vaccinate myself every year for the flu. I've used, of course, COVID vaccinations. So any type of almost vaccine, I think it is very beneficial for the individual, at least, as I'm saying, maybe not for planet Earth, because we are too many nowadays. And thanks to medicine, many people are surviving more than before. And that is kind of overpopulating the Earth in some ways. But yeah, so I am, yes, I would say vaccines are very important, and it has made us survive more as a species.
Judy heard a long COVID clinic report that many of their patients also have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or hypermobility. Could there be shared mechanisms here, but perhaps involving the connective tissue, inflammation, or autonomic dysfunction?
Yes, I do believe that the vascular, so all of our arteries, these are the vessels that, you know, move blood around the body, in migraine individuals are a bit different. And that could perhaps have some type of link to Ehlers-Danlos in some way. So they might have some common mechanisms. But I don't think it is an immediate, you know, kind of reaction that goes to, I mean, or diseases that need to go together all the time. In relation to autonomic dysfunction, and you mentioned POTS, I think, yes, again, migraine attacks trigger or are linked to autonomic transient dysfunction, meaning that during an attack, both your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system kind of gets activated. And that's what we call the autonomic nervous system, which is autonomic because the word comes from being autonomous. You as an individual cannot kind of control it or modulate it, meaning that you cannot say, okay, I want my heartbeat to go faster or slower, or I cannot kind of decide if I want to sweat or not, or if my pupillary kind of reactions dilate or constrict, you know. So all of there's many autonomic dysfunctions, I mean. And when we have an autonomic dysfunction, usually it's not about every part of the autonomous nervous system either. So having said that, I do believe that, again, these two conditions, migraine and POTS, could go together. Again, all of this could and could not be linked to the risk of having long COVID. It doesn't happen in every person that has all of these things that we are mentioning.
I'd like to sort of ask you, how important is pacing, rest, gradual rehabilitation for people who are dealing with fatigue and brain fog along with migraine? And when we talk about energy, are you talking about brain energy or like our body energy? How would you define it?
Yeah, I think in general, taking care of yourself and doing that, for example, as you were mentioning, with movement, you know, rehabilitation, meaning movement, meaning understanding where your thresholds of energetic loss are. So don't go, it's like, don't push it to an overdoing things, you know, kind of going to your limits all the time. So living in a sub-threshold level I think is very useful. And sometimes they have to teach you how to do it. And that's, for me, that's what a rehab, you know, rehabilitation could do for you. Coaching, psychologists, there's many ways of approaching the problem of learning, you know, in a way, and teaching yourself how you are and what your brain is about and your body is about. And then in relation to the second part of the question, energy is in every cell of your body. So our cells have batteries. They are mainly based on, so within a cell, there's many types of things in there. You know, it's kind of also very complex and interesting. And one of them is called the mitochondria. And that is kind of the energetic factory of every cell. So when I'm talking about energy loss, it's global probably. As I'm a neurologist, I would say brain energy, you know, the energy that we have in our brain cells. But no, I believe it's probably quite global. We don't know it. I mean, but yeah, I think cells are quite synchronic. You know, when you start to get tired, it's because all of your cells are starting to get tired. I always say that every morning you wake up with a certain amount of petrol, you know, gasoline, energy that you have. And you have to take care of really making sure that all of the recovery of that energy is properly done. And that's very basic, but it's all about sleeping, eating, as I was saying, movement, basic things that actually refuel your energetic balance.
What gives you hope about the ongoing research in this area, both for understanding long COVID and for improving migraine care in general?
Well, I always say that in migraine research, we need more finance, so more money in general. It is a very underserved, you would say, research area. This doesn't mean, though, that the groups in the world that we are currently doing research, you know, we are kind of able, but it's not easy, and they're very small amounts, but that we are not able to find the resources to do research. But it is very far away from many other neurological diseases. And I'll put as examples, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer, even epilepsy. We still have to do a lot of research to understand how much of that it's, how much could be considered as a progressive disease, how much, you know, we are actually saving the world from and making it valuable for funding bodies, private or public, to give money for research. So much more research should be done. However, I have to admit that from the, you know, small, you would say, or smaller, not, it doesn't mean it's too small, but research that is being done, we have already found several important treatments, and in some other diseases that has not yet happened. So at the end, we kind of make the best of what we have. And luckily, in the 1980s and 90s, so 30, 40 years ago, a basis of what migraine could be, I think it's more complex than what it was thought 40 years ago, but the basis of at least migraine pain was quite well already studied and addressed. And at least we have that covered for many people nowadays. We are still looking into some other peptides, molecules that could be controlled with therapy. And there are currently being trials being done around the world for other new compounds. We still don't know if they will get to the market. They are very what we call early stages of research. But hopefully, I am quite convinced that we will have different approaches to the problem in the future, for sure. And I also hope that we will develop some diagnostic tools, some better ways of quantifying migraine at a biological level, because I think that's the next step that we need as a disease. There's two main things in my mind that we need, and one is longitudinal studies, meaning following individuals across, you know, during life. It's very challenging because people usually you lose them. They get less invested. Their life changes. I mean, there's many things going on. And unlike other diseases where they have been able to follow people during many years, in migraine, it's not as easy, you would say. And then the second big thing, I think, is that we need ways of measuring and quantifying migraine at a biological level, what we call biomarkers, because it will be the only way of probably dignifying the disease in some very tangible way, in a way that you can actually touch, but also probably will give us further insights on what is going on during migraine attacks, in a migraine body, in a migraine brain. So all of these things that are interesting.
Dr. Pozsarosic, it's been a fascinating interview. I've learned a lot about COVID, long COVID and migraine. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Migraine World Summit.
Well, thank you, Carl, for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to participate in the Migraine World Summit. Thank you.